Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends. On today's show is Dr. Emily Silverman, assistant clinical professor at UCSF, a hospitalist with a focus and passion for the humanities. Stay with us. It's going to be a great show.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Everybody, welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
Kaveh's not here with us today. He's in Mexico on a cruise, and I hope it's a very small boat filled with in-laws or a very small boat with only vegan food or a very small boat filled with norovirus. I'm just kidding. I hope he has a wonderful time.
I don't even know what that virus means.
A lot of diarrhea.
Ah,
that's gotcha. All you need to know.
Okay, fair enough.
How we doing, Joe?
You know, I'm doing really, really good, Lizzie.
Why?
I'm a little nervous this episode because we don't have Kaveh here, so I feel like as the third guy, I have to step it up or something.
A, you do, and B, I got you, boo. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine. You're going to do great. How's your week going?
Really, really good. Really good.
No illness to speak of?
You know, I was sick last week. I was sick for a week. I had not strep throat, sore throat.
The other, not strep, herpes.
No herpes this week. Okay. That's a good thing.
Just this week.
What about you?
I'm good. I think the flu season is over. I feel like everybody at work was sick January, February, March. Have you ever heard of the swab or seen it?
No, I don't even know what you're talking about.
It's literally, think about like a Q-tip for your ear. I think about twice as long that the nurse on the floor, the ER nurse, your clinic doctor, someone in an office takes and like jams in the back of your nose to get literally a nasal swab. I learned this recently. I went to a lecture on flu and as a GI doctor, I don't really treat or see it. You know, I have people in my life outside of work who are like, I have a flu and I see nasal swab positive for flu and I see the lab work and I read about it in articles, but I've never actually seen it in life. And then my friend was giving this talk on the flu and sort of showed me what it was to get a flu swab. And it looks like a form of torture.
Really?
Yeah.
It's got to be a blood test, no?
Apparently not. I guess I think the swab is actually very quick, you know, and you can do it and turn around and treat very quickly.
Nasal. What is it? Flu. When I think of the flu, I don't think of nasal. I think of stomach ache. I think of fever, body aches, nasal. That's a cold to me.
I guess that's where the virus sheds the most.
Oh, really?
So you can get a very accurate, quick test. So they, again, jam like a huge Q-tip in the back of your nasal passage, which is really... Seems very uncomfortable.
Doesn't seem very popular either. No. You haven't even used one, right?
I've actually never seen it live. It makes me feel like a bad doctor. I've never had one because I've never had the flu. But the flu, when you feel it, it's head to toe, aches, you know, malaise is the word, where you just feel like you have no energy, you know, and everyone presents a little differently. There's usually fever. That's part of sort of the definition. So... Anyway, the flu season's mostly over, and apparently I don't want to ever get a nasal swab.
I got one question for you, and I think a lot of people have this question related to the flu. This year, we've seen several reports of people dying from the flu, and I've been around for 41 years. I have never seen people dying from the flu, or not, at least not at this rate.
Yeah.
What do you think is the cause of that, or just your best guess? And why do you think the vaccines are not as effective as we've seen in the past?
These are good questions. And again, that lecture I went to maybe can help me, but there's always deaths from flu.
Yeah.
I think this year maybe there are more. I don't know the numbers because it hasn't been as effective. So that's why. Maybe that's why. Not because it's a stronger, crazier, more virulent, toxic flu, but because the vaccine this year, I think, was only 30% or less, maybe 20, 30% effective. And that is just a guessing game. You know, they look at data from like the Southern Hemisphere before and try to guess based on the past strains, but it's always changing, unfortunately. And the targets of the flu, the targeted parts of the protein of the flu change year to year. And the future will be to target a part of the flu virus that doesn't change, but we just don't have the science yet. There are proteins on the membrane that won't that don't change ever, that won't change from year to year. And if we could target that, then that's the cure.
That would cure everything.
Yeah.
That would cure.
But right now we're just behind, just like we talked about the Hep C vaccine.
Right.
Sometimes we just, we're behind, and I'm sure, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years we'll get there.
And so a vaccine is basically creating antibodies so that your body is now familiar with the virus. And therefore if it comes back again, it can't catch it.
Right.
And so when a virus has a slightly different change or mutates is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Then those antibodies don't stop it because they're not familiar with them.
Exactly.
Is that right?
So if you created antibodies to the one protein that doesn't change, then you'd be good. You probably would need one flu shot for 5 years, for 10 years.
We just don't know what doesn't change.
Know what it is, but I guess I don't know the data enough. Yeah. Well, why we're not successful in creating a vaccine to that one thing.
Got it.
Coming up next, we're going to talk to Emily Silverman. Thank you for coming, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Here with us today is Dr. Emily Silverman, assistant clinical professor at UCSF, a hospital-based doctor, also known as a hospitalist, with a focus and passion for the humanities. She organizes a live performance and a podcast called The Nocturnists, emphasizing how we can heal by sharing through storytelling in medicine. Welcome.
Thank you.
So for Joe and our listeners, I'll just sort of get sort of right to the meat. Like, what does humanities mean for you and like medicine? You know, we study humanities. I think about that as like college, you know, or what, I can't even define it.
I know. I would love to define it too. We should look it up later. But the way I think about it is, 10 years ago, there was this woman at Columbia University named Rita Sharon who coined this term narrative medicine. And she wrote a paper about it in JAMA, I think, in 2001. And she defined it as the ability, I'm quoting roughly, but the ability to like construct and be moved to action by narratives. And so now this phrase narrative medicine has been used a lot in academia, kind of vaguely referring to the use of stories to, you know, improve doctor-patient interactions. Usually with a focus on less on live storytelling and more on writing and literature. So there's actually a master's of narrative medicine that you can get at Columbia University. It's like a degree.
It's like the only place you can get it, right?
Yeah.
Because they invented it. It's like we're going to invent a dean of humanities for you, for your future career.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears. I don't have a master's in narrative medicine, but, you know, it seems to me just by browsing the website that they have all these different courses in doctor-patient communication, kind of interpreting literature and using the stories of literature to change the way that you view your role as a doctor and the therapeutic bond. So that's narrative medicine, but in my mind, that's a step down from the humanities, which I view as more of an umbrella term that encompasses, you know, narrative medicine, literature, those sorts of things, but also includes things like music and dance and, you know, history, anthropology, basically anything that doesn't fall under the technical category of the sciences.
Yeah.
You know, any colleges, it'll be like the College of Arts and Sciences.
Yeah.
So anything that falls under arts rather than sciences. So that's how I interpret the humanities, which covers a lot of ground.
Yeah.
I don't have much experience in music or dance or any of those things, but I am very interested in how we might use the non-science disciplines to explore the world of health and illness and disease and suffering and kind of like the subjective experience of medicine.
Yeah. I mean, we talk a lot on the show. First of all, Joe's a drummer.
Oh, cool.
And we talk a lot on the show as you know, things like writing or music and doing a podcast as a way to heal, not heal, but we talk about burnout, I feel like, a lot, because it's such an important part of medicine now, and it's fortunately getting a lot of attention. And we had Sharky LaGuana on talk about music as meditation. But you're talking specifically about bringing these things to the bedside. Is that like sort of the big difference? Because we're talking about how to step away from work and stress and life and recharge. And this is specifically to help patients recharge, you know, when they're ill.
Yeah, I think one way to frame it is physicians should be engaging in these things like hobbies to maintain work-life balance. And that's really important. And that helps with burnout. But I think the other angle is, how can we bring some of these things into our job?
Yeah.
Especially these days when I feel like there is so much focus on how digital health is descending on the healthcare system, and the electronic medical record and big data and everything needs to be evidence-based. And I think all those things are very important. Don't get me wrong. I love science.
You're a doctor.
I'm a doctor. I love science. I love biology. And I definitely think research is incredibly important, obviously. But I also think that there are parts about our jobs that maybe can't be measured. And there's some, literature and medical education too, that shows how we might use the arts and humanities to teach medical students. And I think there's less data on how we might approach our job doctor-patient interaction with more of an artistic bent. So what do I mean by this? For example, I think if you think about collecting a history,
will you elaborate for Joe?
Sure. Okay. So Joe, I work in the hospital, and anytime that a new patient is admitted into the hospital, I write a note. And the structure of the note is the chief complaint, the history of present illness, the physical exam, which includes vital signs, any labs or imaging, and then an assessment and plan. And that's a template, and that's a format that every doctor follows. And I think there's a way to approach that that's very data focused, but there's also a way to tell that story in more of a narrative arc. So not just describing, the patient's had chest pain for 3 days and, is short of breath, and this is their white blood cell count, and this is their x-ray, which shows an pneumonia, but really trying to contextualize the illness within the framework of their life. So like, who is this person?
Right.
And like, how might this pneumonia impact the trajectory of their life, their functional status, their relationships, their career, their job, and those sorts of things. So I think that kind of way of thinking strikes me as more of an arts and humanities way of thinking than like a science way of thinking.
Yeah, you're why is this guy here for the fourth time with a heart failure exacerbation? Oh, he wasn't taking his meds. But then if you start digging deep, why wasn't he taking his meds? You know, and it is an art. You know, that's what we learn in med school and then in and beyond, how to write a note. You know, do I write this patient has a history of thyroid disease, osteoporosis, blah, 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 who comes in with 3 days of chest pain? Like, nobody cares about your osteoporosis if you're having a heart attack. You know, there is an art to it. And I do think if someone writes a note really well, they can probably communicate to other doctors better and maybe care for the patient better. You know, there's so much sign out and there's so many handoffs that if we did focus on that, I could see how that could really also improve like data, because you do need numbers, unfortunately. You know, you can't just say, let's bring humanities, it's good for people. You have to say, let's bring the humanities to the bedside because there's actual outcome. I mean, that's just the way financing is in our healthcare system, you know?
Yeah, I think they enhance each other. I think, you know, if you just spent your day sitting down asking people about their lives, like, you're not a doctor. But if you just spent the day, you know, looking at somebody's lab numbers and prescribing them an antibiotic and saying, have a nice day, you're also not really being a doctor. I think being a doctor is kind of blending the two and, you know, thinking about the person's body and their disease state, but also figuring out how that fits into the greater story of their lives and communicating that as such. And I think people upload the data much more easily if it's framed as a story than they do if it's just kind of like a Jackson Pollock of like labs and imaging and there's no framework to hang it on.
That is the art of medicine, is synthesizing the story, the data, the numbers, and presenting it in a meeting, and we do it every day all the time without thinking about it, but I'm sure that it can be done better.
Yeah, and I think it probably can be taught, and I think one way to teach it is, you know, let's take a writing course, let's do some improv, let's, you know, there are so many different ways to get at that skill set. Let's do a public speaking course, yeah. Persuasive communication. There's a lot of different skills, I think, that are integral to being a physician that aren't really emphasized in the medical school curriculum.
Yeah.
Really, really important stuff. I'm really happy to hear that there's this kind of thinking going on in the medical field, because you're right, the data will tell you what's going on, but the story will tell you why it's going on. And a lot of times, if you get in front of the why, then you can prevent that kind of stuff. So it's really, I think it's almost as important as the scientific part of medicine is that personal touch, knowing the patient, their tendencies, all those things. What's the challenge there? Or the challenge there would be, how do you get that information out of patients? Mm-hmm. How do you get on a personal level? Can you talk to that at all? Do you have an approach that you use, or standard set of questions, or?
Sure, I can tell you what I do, and I've thought a little bit about how I might teach that skill set to other people, and I haven't actually formalized that or solidified that yet, but I can tell you some of my early thoughts since I'm early in my career.
Trademark Emily Silverman.
Disclaimer up front, not an expert, but honestly, so there's a few things that you can do that are actually very easy and concrete. So when you go into the room, sitting down, sitting in a chair, I believe there is a study actually that shows that patients perceive that you are spending more time with them than you truly are if you're sitting as opposed to if you're standing.
Yeah, huh.
And really?
So, you know, Joe, when we do rounds in the morning or in the afternoon, whenever, it's usually you, and I'm sure at UCSF it's a resident, maybe an intern, maybe a med student, a team of people, four or five people, usually like
standing
down, patient's lying in bed, and we're all like standing down. Yeah. And like how Kaveh talked about his ENT experience where everyone's just like at you, you know, there's nothing with you. It's like everything's being done at you because there is a time constraint, let's be honest. But yeah, sitting down would be a wonderful piece of advice for our doctors, which we also like to do on this show, is talk about what advice would you give your doctor, you know?
And hospitals and clinics can help with that. I mean, in clinic, it's not an issue because usually you're in an office and both people are sitting. But in the hospital, there are some floors where there's actually like a folding chair hanging on a peg, like behind the door, for example. So you can just lift it up, unfold it, sit down.
Yeah.
Takes 2 seconds. Very easy. So I think sitting down is the first step, not only because it makes them feel like you're listening to them, but I think it also reduces the power dynamic a little bit, to be a vulnerable sick person, in a hospital gown with like parts of your body hanging out that you don't want to be hanging out. And then to have, you know, a person in a white coat, like standing over you. I think having that person sit down and kind of get on your level. Sometimes I'll even squat if there's no chair in the room, and just kind of like hang my hands over the handrail so I'm face to face with the person. I think that as a first step can go a pretty long way.
And just to bring it to the clinic, because I do both, I think, you know, you're sitting there typing. If you just look at the patient or say to the patient, you know, I'm listening, I'm just going to type at the same time. You know, if you just sort of call out to it, because otherwise people don't feel heard. And if you're just typing or looking at the computer, it's a skill. And unfortunately, older doctors haven't learned this skill of typing and talk. You have to be efficient, but that maybe is the equivalent of sitting down next to a patient, is looking or calling attention to what you're going to be doing for the next 15, 20 minutes of the visit, you know?
Absolutely. The computer is such a barrier. And I don't think anyone anticipated that consequence. They thought, you know, having the notes be electronic will be so great, so efficient, but then you end up with these doctors who aren't even like looking at their patients. So I think breaking eye contact with the computer and looking at the patient every few minutes, and even apologizing and saying, sorry that I'm typing, introducing the computer. I think I saw a list on a whiteboard once of like the first steps to a patient encounter. One of them was introduce the computer, which is so sad, but I think
this is Johnny
can help. Yeah, we should name them.
Step one, name the computer. Step two, introduce the computer.
And when you do that, I find that patients usually react really well, and they're happy to let you do your job and talk to them at the same time. So anyway, those are some simple things up front that you can do. And then the other thing I do is, usually when I go into the room, I have some sort of agenda. So I want to assess, you know, how is the person's abdominal pain? How is the person's rash? Is the infection on their leg getting any better, getting any worse? But before diving into that immediately, I'll just say, you know, what's on your mind this morning? A just super open-ended question. And you'll be very surprised by what people say, because you might think that they're worried about their pneumonia, but really they're worried because they ran out of minutes on their cell phone and they need to call their landlord to
feed the cat.
Exactly.
I've heard the cat thing.
The cat thing, pets, you know, family drama, relationship drama that's going on. I mean, sometimes you'll elicit something immediately that's like very intense. You know, I'm worried about going home to my partner because I'm involved in like an abuse situation. You know, you could really tease out. People are dying to tell you actually what's on their mind, and all you really have to do is ask them.
I feel like it's a great point. And again, I definitely can remember this one woman who now loves me, but she was like, I have to leave. She had horrible ulcerative colitis. I have to leave the hospital to feed my cats, to pay my bills. I'm really stressed out. And I was like, this is your health. You could die. You know, you'll be in the hospital. You'll get emergency surgery if we don't do this. And we talked about it, but I felt powerless to do the cat thing and the landlord thing and the bill thing. So I have to say, I appreciated she told me, but I couldn't hear it because I don't know how we're doctors. Like, I want a problem and I want to be able to try to fix it at least. Mm-hmm. I cannot fix that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably why I don't routinely, or we maybe as a profession don't routinely ask that stuff, because it makes me feel powerless and I don't like that. I like to know
it's kind
everything.
Of like opening Pandora's box. Yeah. And the person says, well, what I'm thinking about this morning is that I'm homeless and I really need a place to live. And then, I mean, I get that one all the time, and that makes me feel powerless because I wish I could give housing to all of my patients.
But you're right. It's probably just about venting and listening, but I want to act, unfortunately. You know, that's my problem.
Venting, listening, validating, you know, often there's some sort of social work resource that you can deploy that may help, even if it's baby steps. But I agree with you. I think it's very hard to recognize how much people's health is blended with their social situation. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to kind of draw that magic line around yourself. Like, where do my responsibilities begin and where do they end? Yeah. You know, how much of my job is to help this person get their diabetes under control, and how much of my job is to help this person find stable housing? And I think that's a tension that you're on. And even with substance abuse, you know, how much of my job is to keep this person here so that they don't leave the hospital and go use substances? At a certain point, the person's going to do what they're going to do. And you as the doctor can't control that. And so I think finding that balance and knowing when to let go, when to forgive yourself, and when to enter in kind of a Zen-like state of peace and acceptance over the world's imperfectness is something that I'm constantly striving toward.
Yeah. I have this, again, not to talk about all my patients, a couple people who are really, you know, as GI, we do liver with cirrhosis, and a couple people who just keep drinking. And last week I got on the phone with someone and I was like, at the end, you know, I'm rooting for you. And I feel like she really was so touched by it, you know, cause I don't know what else to say. I told her to stop drinking. I've tried to refer her to substance abuse counselors dozens of times, called, emailed, letter. And at the end I said that, and I, you know, who knows what'll happen. I'll update you guys on the, no, I won't. But, I just, that to me was like, I'm going to start saying that, you know, cause I feel like I am powerless. All I can do is encourage you and root for you, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I think that can go a long way.
Yeah.
Because some of our patients who are really vulnerable don't have voices of support like that in their life.
Yeah.
They don't have people who are rooting for them. They have destructive relationships. They have chaotic social lives. People are constantly betraying them, stabbing them in the back, stealing their things. You know, they'll go to a shelter and somebody will steal their backpack with all their medicines in it. And so these people sometimes come in very guarded and very defensive. And sometimes I like to imagine that even if, you know, I send them right back out to the situation that they're coming from, and I know they're going to come right back in a week with the same issue, at least I know that while I'm taking care of them, the act of treating them with kindness and respect and telling them that I'm rooting for them, mm-hmm. I hope is like a small incremental step towards some sort of change over time.
Yeah. And trust in the system, if that's part of the problem.
Right.
So sitting with a patient, mm-hmm. Asking open-ended, like, what's on your mind? Mm-hmm. Do you have any other? Because these are good bits.
Yeah. What else? I don't know. I probe a lot. I like to explore things with patients. So, and you know, initially it may seem like it's not pertinent, but then it might curve around into a goals of care discussion, for example.
Yeah.
If a person has, say, I saw a guy last night who had metastatic cancer, and just started asking him about his apartment and his neighbor, and then that conversation very quickly evolved or devolved, whatever you want to call it, into a discussion about the fact that he was really suffering and he'd been fighting for 4 years and he didn't really know what he was fighting for anymore and he didn't want to suffer anymore. And so I feel like actually asking about things that seem unrelated can be a trust building activity that then lets the patient open up and then give you the information later on that I think you're really after. Whereas if you walk into somebody's room and you say, like, how's your chest pain? Like, do you want us to do CPR on you if your heart stops? Which can feel like a really abrupt question, and one that we have to ask every patient we admit. And sometimes I forget to ask it, and then, you know, my hand's on the doorknob, and then I turn around, and then I'm like, oh, by the way, like, if your heart stops, like, do you want us to, like, you know, press on your chest, give you electric shocks? Yeah. And it just feels like the wrong way to get at that issue, but it's like a checkbox I have to tick off.
Yeah.
So I think...
Did you see the news today? How's the weather? And do you want your heart to be, you know, your rib cage broken and your heart pounding upon?
It's kind of morbid, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think arriving at that issue through, like, more naturally through a normal conversation can be helpful. There was a piece written about a woman, it was by a woman at Harvard who does primary care. And her patient never really opened up to her. She was one of those people who you would probe and you would ask open-ended questions and just didn't really want to give you much. But then one day the patient pulled out a pen, and this doctor was like a pen aficionado. She like collected quills and pens and things. And she was like, oh my God, what kind of pen is that? And then the patient opened up and she was like, it's this type of pen. And they talked about the pen for a long time. And then 10 minutes later, the patient's like, all right, I'll take my insulin. So I really think that we lose sight of how much that human connection part of the interaction is important and how it might impact the way that the patient responds to our medical recommendations.
Yeah. And then you said there's such a focus on evidence, and we know evidence is important. We know data is important, but we all know that evidence becomes evidence based on accumulation of experiences and anecdotes. So you're the one who sees that the way that rash looks over and over and over in this patient with this unique disease. And you're the one who can remember it last time and bring your experience to something. And again, accumulated experiences become studies and evidence, you know? So it has to start somewhere. We have to use our own personal anecdotes, you know?
Right.
And people in medicine are sort of fearful of anecdotal, but if I do a procedure and I have a polyp with cancer, the next guy, I'm more worried about cancer and I can't change that, you know?
Right.
It's human nature, so...
Right. We all bring our biases to the table. And I think, you know, being rigorous and measuring things and being scientific is incredibly important. But I wonder sometimes, for example, with a project like mine, The Nocturnus, which is a live storytelling event where people come together in a room or in a theater and listen to stories. A lot of people have asked me, you know, have you done any research on this? Have you tried to measure the impact? And there probably isn't a great way to do that. I think the closest you probably could get is doing surveys pre and post. Yeah. But I just don't know. I just don't know if that's really the way I would want to go with it. Like, I'm just imagining someone coming out of the experience, having heard all those stories and then being asked to fill out a survey. I don't know if that's the right way. I don't know if it's measurable.
Right. I went to a show, Joe. The theme was love. And these people, most of them were doctors that I saw. I think you said that that's generally who your performers are. And they just got up there, a microphone, one person with this essay that they clearly rehearsed and sort of told it very animatedly. I don't know, again, if it's a selection bias, but these people did such a great job really expressing their experience. Again, most of them were doctors, but one had a perspective of a patient. One had a perspective of, you know, a woman dating a man with a disease and what that meant for them, you know, and it was really moving. And I, you know, I have no idea how you would quantify that. You know, I think, again, most of the audience, I assume, are healthcare associated, affiliated people. At the beginning, you definitely had us, you know, if you're a doctor, raise your hand. If you're a nurse, raise your hand. So you have to hope that these people will bring that back to their job. But it's clearly not a direct performance and patient, you know. There's two steps involved there. So I don't know how you measure that.
Yeah, it's hard to put in a spreadsheet, that's for sure.
Yeah, you need a data nerd.
Yeah, yeah.
Joe, are you a data nerd?
I am a data nerd, but big time, actually. I'm a big econ financial analyst type nerd. So I use a lot of data, but there's always at the end of the day, a little bit of common sense you have to do and really look at the data and if it's relevant and how it's measured and how it's calculated. Those are important questions too. So kind of both. So
yeah. When I was a med student, I went to NYU. I think I told you we have the Bellevue Literary Review there. So there is a focus on humanities, and this is, you know, 10 years ago or so. I do remember going on rounds with this one attending who was really passionate about the humanities and, you know, incorporating this into your work day, your workflow. And we would sit around. And again, I was also an intern there. So we'd sit around. She'd pass out poems or an essay. And during work rounds where you're supposed to present one patient at length. There's no patient in the room. It's just 8 of us, 10 of us sitting at a table like this, you know, talking about the patients that we met last night or this morning and really learning about them and going really deep into the disease and the story, hopefully. But before, she would sit around and pass out these poems and have us read it. And I remember reading them and thinking they're great poems, but also being so angry because I had 472 things to go do, notes to write, blood to draw, things to read and think about in order. And it really did not work. And I remember thinking, I would love this to read at home.
Right.
And to incorporate this into the middle of my work day, I really was very resentful, you know? So it's really hard to do that. Like, I think it's great to bring it to the patient and the bedside, but to stop your day and to, and I don't regret it. I mean, I wouldn't say don't do it. I think it's a great thing to stop and remember to think about something other than work, you know, and to think about a patient's experience or whatever in the middle of the day. But I don't remember being that appreciative in the moment. Maybe I would now, but
yeah, I think, that's a really great point. It reminds me of the famous story from Tom Sawyer, where Tom Sawyer is painting the fence and he's bored. He doesn't want to be painting the fence. He wants to be out playing. And then Huck Finn walks by, I think it is, or maybe another kid. And the kid says, "What are you doing, Tom?" And he's like, "I'm painting this fence. It's the greatest thing in the world. You know, I'm painting it and you're not." And the kid's like, "No, I want to paint it. Let me paint it." And he's like, "Nope." And he's like, "Please, please." And he begs him. And then finally he gives him the brush and then lets the kid paint it. And then Tom Sawyer thinks, "Aha." And then he goes off and plays. I think like it's all about, how it's framed. Like if it's framed as something that's like really desirable, for example, with my events, I'm very careful that they're off campus. They're not in the hospital. They're away from the sterile clinical environment. They're not in like a conference room under fluorescent lights. They're in beautiful spaces, theaters, art galleries. They're in the evenings. There's booze there. You know, it's like all about kind of how you frame up the incentives and they sell out and people want to come. But I think you're right. I think if you're trying to like jam it into an intern's already very busy day when they're just like not in that mental space, it can be really, really actually like harmful.
Yeah.
And I think that argument spills over into the entire physician wellness, I guess, discussion that's happening right now.
Yeah.
I think certain med schools and residencies are trying to create wellness by having like mandated residency Olympics or mandated like residency meditation retreats. I think without understanding that people kind of need to decide for themselves
right.
what restores them and that if it's forced upon them as like another to-do on their list, that right. it's actually really counterproductive. So I think that's a really good point.
Yeah. We've talked about it before. We remember we had talked about like mandatory after work events or after work meetings. Yeah. And I'm like making homework into this stuff, you know, is just, you do need to carve out time maybe in the middle of the work day to make people sort of more grateful and appreciative of all that stuff. So anyway, Kaveh did want to ask one thing.
Sure.
He said that he read a study that med students in particular, like before and after med school, there was like a survey and that across the board, you know, the concept of humanity. I don't know what questions were specifically asked, but like, you know, do you like people? Do you want to work with people? That kind of stuff. What are you hopeful for people? Like the whole concept of humanity, these surveys plummeted before and after. I think it was med school was the intervention, you know? And I mean, have you read that study? Is that part of like something that kind of led you to what you're doing today? How did you get interested in this?
I'm sure there are a few studies to that effect. I can't quote any of them off the top of my head, but I think it's a pretty well-recognized phenomenon that empathy levels, are fairly high with a young, naive, bushy-tailed medical student. And then when, as you go through residency, it just like nosedives. Yeah. And that's not surprising, right? For anyone who's gone through residency, it's not surprising. Yeah. For example, if you are working 12, 14-hour days and your pager's going off constantly, which is terrible for concentration, and you've been doing this for 80 hours a week for months on end and haven't had a minute to do anything for yourself, and you're busy and you're tired, and you have a patient, for example, who you're trying to discharge out of the hospital and they don't want to leave. And so right as you're discharging, they say like, I want to kill myself, and then you have this like jaded mentality. You're like, I know this person doesn't actually want to kill myself. I know they're just saying this because they want to stay in the hospital.
Right.
And I feel like as a med student, if someone said to you, I want to kill myself, you would be like, oh my God. And you sit down on the bed
right.
and explore it with them. But I feel like it's just so easy to get jaded and to feel like you're being manipulated and to manipulate all because you're just, it's just, you're overloaded with work to do.
Right.
And I think it's necessary that you kind of put up a barrier. So, I don't find it surprising that empathy levels decline over residency. As for the question of whether or not that drives my work, I think it does. It wasn't as directed as like, I read this study about empathy and then I decided that was a problem. And it was like, it was more like, I noticed it in myself. Like right. I didn't need a study to explain to me that this was happening. I felt it in myself. Like I started to walk in a room and see a young dying woman who was curled up in a ball, her mom holding her crying. And then I left the room and I was like, oh, I can't examine her. Like right. I'll have to come back later, And then like, and then you see yourself and you're like, right. I'm a monster.
You're like, her cancer's really screwing up my day.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I saw that in myself and that scared me. Yeah. And so, I think that is really what drove me to try to reconnect with my human side because, by that time I just felt like a ghost kind of drifting through the hospital and just kind of putting one foot in front of the other and hoping for the best. So
there should be some mandatory part of the curriculum at the end of intern year, middle of intern year, where you're really, that's probably your lowest, your nadir of like, sleeplessness, depression, sort of disillusionment with like the whole thing of medicine and just to actually just take a day off from work where everyone does sort of talk about it and debrief. I feel like that is important to, you are aware of it. You're lucky there are some people who don't realize ever or find out too late before they really did something wrong,
Yeah, I actually love that idea of like a mid-residency retreat where they kind of put out like shack everyone up at a winery or something and just like all read poetry together. Right. I mean,
because the paperwork is there, mid-year evaluations, end-of-year evaluations. And we know going through it, when your boss sits you down and says, you're doing a good job, have you met these? It's all check boxes. Very rarely is it a meaningful, how are you? What's on your mind
today? How's your soul?
How's your soul?
One of my friends, Katie, she always used to say to me, she would just look at me like kind of cocking her head and she'd be like, how's your soul?
And is she a doctor?
She's a doctor. She's a rheumatologist now.
Yeah.
And I've started asking people that now. That's kind of how I, and when you ask people that question, they know exactly what you mean.
Right.
And they'll sometimes answer pretty honestly and they'll be like, I'm okay.
Yeah. Ask me tomorrow.
Ask me. Yeah.
Well, this has been great. Joe, do you have any other questions?
I have just one more. It's just a quick clarification. I read a lot about you before this, and I know that you are a hospitalist. Mm-hmm. As a patient, what is the difference between a hospitalist and a specialist at a hospital, like an organ specialized person? What is a hospitalist, I guess, is my question.
Great question. So a hospitalist is sort of like the equivalent of a primary care doctor, but in the hospital. Mm. So, let's say that you are feeling sick. Generally, unless you already have some sort of rare disease, your first stop is going to be your primary care doctor. And many issues your primary care doctor can kind of handle on their own. But obviously, if things get a little bit too complicated, they would refer you out to a specialist. And so that's how I operate. People come into the emergency room feeling sick. Either the emergency room stabilizes them and sends them back out, or the emergency room deems them too sick to leave the hospital and they admit them to the hospital. And that's where I come in. So I'm kind of like the primary care doctor, and I come and meet you. We talk, I evaluate you. Let's say you have something like a pneumonia, or you're wheezing because of your COPD from smoking, or you have like a skin infection, or any of those basic things I can handle on my own. But if there's something going on that's that requires a little bit of extra attention from
like
a specialist.
If a patient swallows something ridiculous, like a razor.
Great example.
Well, because we talked about
that. Or the other way, that something gets stuck.
Right, or a carrot in the butt.
Yes. Thank you, Lizzie. You're good.
Yeah, I call someone else for that.
Right. I mean, I'm sure more. It's probably.
So they go to ER first. Once they're stabilized, then you kind of take over everything else. Is that?
Yeah, ideally, when you go to the ER, you're stabilized and then you can go home without ever even coming in. But if you go to the ER and you're sick enough that the ER doctors think like, this person's going to need like really a few days or more, then they bring you into the hospital. And then that's when I take care of the person. And I have patients who stay in the hospital for a day, 2, 3, 4 days. I have patients who stay in the hospital for weeks. It just depends how sick you are.
And on that, it's along those lines is the nocturnist. I've also heard it nocturnalist, which is a nighttime hospital-based doctor because they cover the hospital 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Back in the day when our parents were doctors, they would have office hours, you know, and have to see their patients in the hospital before, middle, or after. It was really, really cramming it all in. And the culture now in the last 15 years, 20 years, is more hospital residing, hospital based, hospitalist medicine. So it is it's better and worse. You know, our older patients are like, I want to see my doctor, but it really, you know, it is a specialty. Clinical medicine, outpatient medicine, and hospital medicine really are very different.
Yeah.
And I know people who've gone back and forth, some do both, and they don't feel comfortable if they're not doing one or the other routinely.
Yeah, the types of problems that you run into, the types of diseases, conditions are really different. And it's funny because if you talk to somebody who's been doing hospital medicine for a long time, they just kind of, I mean, I don't want to speak for others, but for me anyway, I kind of am a little bit weaker on my primary care, you know, people coming in with like a little bit of a rash or, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. My pinky toe hurts, like those sorts of questions. I'm not as good as approaching. Whereas if somebody comes in and they have an oxygen requirement and they need a CAT scan, like those are, things I'm more comfortable with. And I think vice versa.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things to emphasize is that because now patients are seen by different doctors in the hospital and in the clinic, it's very important that we create smooth care transitions back and forth. So when I admit a patient to the hospital, one of the first things I do is I ask, who is your primary care doctor? And then I call or email that person, you know, to let them know that their patient's in the hospital, to open up a conversation. Same thing when they're discharged. And that communication, I think, can either be better or worse depending on systems and how easy it is to get in touch with them, whether it's a weekend, all those things.
Thank you so much for being here. The podcast and the live show is called The Nocturnist. So anyone can listen to the podcast. The Nocturnist is specific to San Francisco. And again, it was totally, I thought it was great. And I'm not blowing smoke. It was really, I found it totally captivating, compelling. And like I told, you know, other people, the next one's April 20th. So can you give us information on how people can find you or information about the Nocturnists?
Sure. If you want to know about me, I have a website. It's just my name, emilysilverman.com. And you can read my bio and read some of my own personal writing if you like. And if you want to learn more about my project, The Nocturnists, you can go to www.thenocturnists.com. It has an S on the end, thenocturnists.com. And there you can find all the information about our events, and upcoming events, and you can subscribe and be notified not only when events are coming up, but also when we put out calls for submission. So if you want to tell a story at a Nocturnist event, hop on our list and please submit in the future.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Thank you to Emily Silverman for coming on the show. Please keep the emails and phone calls coming. Email us at hopquestions@gmail.com. Call us at 408-444-6623. And make sure to like us on Facebook, review us on iTunes, and tell your friends to listen.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.